Good morning and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Leportevin Group conference call. If at any time during this call you need assistance, please press star zero for the operator. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. David Leportevin. Please go ahead.
Thanks, operator. Welcome, everyone. We're going to go with a slightly different format, and I'm going to speak for my usual rambling on, and Mark's going to go through what we're going to do for questions here. So, Mark, just can you briefly tell them what we're going to try on this call?
Yeah, so we've been sent a series of questions that we'll get to at the end. If, however, you have another question, I'm going to be on my email during the call, and you're welcome to email, and we'll try to get to it. My email is mrinfret@cgf.com. So that's Mother Romeo India November Foxtrot Romeo Echo Tango at charliegolffrank.com. And you can email me, and we'll try and fit it in at the end. And if not, we'll get back to you after the call.
mrinfret@cgf.com. Okay. Yeah. And so we'll try to go with that because it burns a lot of time with the operator and questions and pauses. And, you know, we had all these delays last time. So we're going to try that. So I'll jump in here. You might notice a little bit of a skip in our step, and that's because the markets have done something very, very interesting. Really, the sea change actually was about August 30th, 31st. And that is that the markets have really done something interesting, which is we were at a period in the markets where the major indexes were really masking what was going on in the underlying market. So in other words, you know, you're buying a new car, but what's under the hood? And what was under the hood in this market was a much more challenging environment that the indexes were leading on to. And the major indexes being the Dow or the S&P, although they were flat from January of 2018, we actually saw the Value Line Index, which the Value Line Index measures 3,500 stocks, not just 30 like the Dow. So and it is not market cap weighted. So that really says what is the average stock doing. And while the S&P hit a peak of January 2018 and is now up 4%, the Value Line from January even to today was minus 8%. And at one point was worse than 20% down from those peaks. The index itself, for example, in January, the Value Line Index was 590 in 2018. It's 533 at minus 10, whereas the S&P from that period is plus 4. So there was a real divergence in really what was under the hood being the average stock. And you know, I'll quote you something from that was on CNBC in their online site. It was from Michael Burry of The Big Short, and he said that he's found and identified the next market bubble. And what he's talking about on those bubbles is the average investor is fleeing into indexes, and they're fleeing into two types of indexes. One is the bond market, and so they're buying unwillingly bonds that they had never really owned before. They might have owned some GICs or some shorter-term bonds that they would typically hold to maturity. And all of a sudden, they own a whole bunch of 10, 20, and 30-year bonds through the exchange-traded funds. And yet, at the end of August, we were at this hysterical point. And the hysteria was the yield curve had inverted. And by the way, the inversion was 1 basis point. Difference between a 2-year and a 10-year. And again, that means an inversion because normally the 10-year is higher. And, you know, we have this divergence where in yields and people were, the hysteria was we're foregone conclusion, we're hitting into a recession, number one. And number two is interest rates around the globe are all going to go to negative simultaneously. And I would say the bond market was looking at the end of August like maybe the biggest bubble we have ever seen in our lifetimes. and it reminded me a lot of the tech bubble. So how does a bond bubble look like a tech bubble? Well, the 30-year government of Canada hit 1.34%. And as I said, I want to meet the guy that says, I would like to buy that bond at 1.34 and own it for 30 years. And like the tech bubble, nobody really thought that stocks were good value because the NASDAQ stock market in 2000 at the peak had hit a price earnings of a 100 times. And yet at 1.34, we're almost at the same valuation of the tech bubble. But people bought tech stocks because they were going up. The other thing they did was one tech stock was undervalued relative to another one. And if you look at the 30-year British gilts in the UK, they yield 0.9. So at the same token, you could say, well, the government of Canada is undervalued relative to Britain, or it's undervalued relative to the German Bunds. Yes, it is. But at the end of the day, if we look back at the tech bubble, that was one of the greatest mistakes people made, was I'm going to buy this tech stock because it's trading at 100 times earnings, and that other tech stock, well, and it was a discount to the other one trading at 200 times earnings, and people lost some money on those kind of relative valuations. So on August 31st, the bond market reached its highest level, and again, there was hysteria that yields would go negative. But since that time, a funny thing has happened, and that is bonds have started falling, and if you own that bond fund or you own TLT, you're minus 4% for the month. But the other interesting thing is the S&P did correct in August. It's up 2.5%, but that value line index, which measures all stocks, is now up 6%. So the reason that the Laporte Group has a skip in their steps is that, well, we weren't performing as badly as the value line index. We weren't performing up to the indexes. And people are, if you look at your statements this month, they've done pretty bloody well. And like Michael Burry is talking about the Big Short and the investing public, and I just outlined the bubble in bonds, which is one of the things he's talking about. The other bubble is, you know, people have been flooding into indexes themselves as the stock market index. And the most popular index in the world is the S&P 500. And those indexes, if you look at the large cap tech stocks, Netflix and Facebook, and we're looking at extremely high PEs, typically north of 30 to 40 times. So the indexes are dominated by these mega cap tech, and they're dominated by consumer staples. And it's interesting to note that while the average stock is doing very, very well this month, the darlings of the past, Starbucks, Procter & Gamble, Coke, Johnson & Johnson, McDonald's, are down, 4% on McDonald's, up 1% in Procter & Gamble, Coke's minus 1%, Starbucks is minus 6%. The price-earnings ratio of Starbucks is 32 times. Great company, but it's not cheap. Procter & Gamble is 26 times. The stock trades at 121, and Value Line, which we use as one of our research tools, has a target price 5 years out of between $105 and $130. So when we sold Procter & Gamble in the 90s, it looked fully valued. It's gone higher, but it's interesting how what was pushing it higher was all these flows of the investing public pushing these indexes, and the indexes were weighted to these mega, the biggest ones, higher and higher. So you could buy these consumer staples, and you could buy with the masses, or you could buy Walgreens at 10 times, General Motors at 6 times, American Airlines at 8 times, Penske Auto, which is one of the largest auto dealers in the world, at 8 times, Occidental Petroleum at 9 times, Wells Fargo at 10 times, KB Home at 11 times earnings. And this is my point of valuation. So the thing about this is patience, and sometimes it does take patience, and I think we're in a very, very good spot. I think going forward, as I pointed out, this inversion of the yield curve, which didn't seem to last for more than an hour or two, and then would the 10-year would go higher or the short yield would go lower, has really kind of rectified itself. The 10-year bond yields have been, price have been falling and yields have been going up. So the yield curve is no longer inverted at the 2 to 10, which is your classic indicator. And so the market is kind of waking up to the fact that the economic data has been far stronger than anyone, you know, all these naysayers in August that said foregone conclusion, recession. We got consumer confidence high. We had retail sales where we're way higher than expected. And while there is this predictable slowdown in manufacturing, the manufacturing index came in at 49. Anything below 50 shows a contraction. But the services sector index, which is three times the size of the manufacturing in the United States, is coming in at a very, very strong 56. So at the end of the day, the economy is not operating at full capacity, but at the end of the day, this move to zero rates and the sky is falling was not the correct trade, and anybody that sort of played that in August is losing money, whereas people that just kind of stayed calm and cool and bought low-value stocks are doing very, very well this month. So I would say that the outlook is that stay the course and don't change our philosophy. The most famous book ever written was written by Benjamin Graham called The Intelligent Investor. And if you're going to read one book, that's the one. And, you know, that's the formula for Warren Buffett. It was the formula that John Templeton would use, or Peter Lynch that ran that Fidelity Magellan Fund that did 29% a year during the 80s. And, you know, good value stocks is the thing that works in the long run. But every once in a while, people clamor and they want more of the highly valued stocks. So, anyway, that's where we are. The outlook, as I said, looks pretty decent from now to year end. People talk about September and October being the cruelest months. Well, about 10 years ago, everyone figured out that September is the worst month. So guess what became the worst month? It became August. So people wised up and said, well, let's sell in August. So now August is the first month. In the next decade, it might be July. Who knows? But it's hard to play these little 2 to 3% correction moves. As I said, we're happy to own our cheap stocks. Earnings are growing. We're collecting dividends, and dividends are growing. And that's a pretty good formula. So, Mark, you've got some pre-questions. You've got some questions that people have emailed. Why don't we start with that and see where that goes?
Okay. So Hugh asks, what are the implications to the financial community regarding the upcoming U.S. election?
Well, that's something we've been talking about in our calls for the last couple months. Excellent question. And one of the things that I pointed out at the beginning of this year was that the presidential cycle says that the third and fourth year of the stock markets are far better than the first and second year. And here we are the third year, and it feels not that great, but the accounts are doing pretty well this year. And that's because it's the pre year to the election year. And what tends to happen is that tough things that the stock market isn't going to like tend to not be brought forward. So the trade war was initiated a year ago, at the end of last year, which is your second year term, which is the worst year of the stock market. You tend to try to wind these things down going into the last year. So it's highly unlikely we're going to get this new round of really bad news, because the one predictor that predicts presidents is the stock market. And if you're George Bush Sr., who was very well-liked, didn't get a second term because the market was down. George Bush Jr., not so well-liked, got a second term because the stock market was up. And Trump knows this above all else and brags about stocks. So the politics should be on our side instead of at our face.
Okay, question from Gord. Can you comment on what impact you feel the media has had in creating elevated levels of concern or panic over the past year, and how that may have altered investor sentiment?
Interesting question. Look, the media does not like Trump. In fact, most Canadians don't like Trump. And 50% of Americans don't like Trump. So media especially, it has increased the volatility. We were talking to one of our clients, and we talked about the return of the last 2 to 3 years. And at the end of the day, it was pretty good return. But at the end of the day, it's the volatility that he doesn't like. And this is perhaps the new reality. And if we want to achieve returns of 6-7%, we need to identify that. Again, we've got the bond market, which you could buy a GIC at 2 with an inflation rate of 2, and you're going to pay tax on that. Then there's no volatility. Every month you look at your statement, you're going to be up 0.18% per month, and there'll be no volatility. I would not be happy with that myself. So I guess we're just going to have to live with that.
Okay, Rod wonders if you have any thoughts long-term, which he defines as 3 to 5 years out, considering world debt has expanded considerably since the last debt crisis 10 years ago, and can you explain why people would lend money for a negative return?
I'm not a big fan of negative interest rates. I would rather see higher inflation, not lower, or quantitative easing. 3 to 5 years is hard to say because at the end of the day, bull markets end with higher inflation, and bull markets end when the Fed is pushing against that higher inflation. So if we look back to 2007, we had $140 oil, and we had the Fed that inverted the curve, and not like a few minutes, the curve was inverted, and they continued to raise rates for another 1 year. So we stayed inverted on the curve, lending tightened up. So the answer to the question is 3 to 5 years is difficult to say. I'm looking out towards the next U.S. election. I'm fairly constructive. If oil keeps going, commodities keep going, I mean, there's a very interesting news item yesterday, which is General Motors on strike. I mean, this is not deflationary. We haven't seen strike activity in really, this is the first GM strike in 12 years. We haven't seen that kind of activity, but there hasn't been the confidence to go to GM and say, we want more money. We have full employment. So there's a much higher degree of confidence. And if we look back at the higher inflation 80s and 90s, there would be striking action, you know, it would make the news weekly. So this may be a one-off, and it may be just sort of union kind of trying to reestablish themselves. But it also may be indicative that inflation, in fact, may be picking up. You know, everyone talks about these negative rates, and Europe's going to zero and $16 trillion of global debt. Yet the U.S. inflation rate, the core rate is 2.4%, and the actual inflation rate without energy and food, which is the volatile component, is 2. Inflation's picking up, not going down. And all these bond guys think, oh, no, that data is wrong. But what will kill it is if that inflation rate keeps going higher and wages start going up and prices start going up. That's what's going to kill this, and that's killed every cycle. So it's hard. I can't look out 3 to 5 years, but we will react.
Okay, similar question from Carol and Alex. Can you explain how often you reevaluate individual security performance, specifically those that have dropped or trade for less than our original cost? Since most of our positions have performed well, doesn't it make sense to sell some of the losers that have little prospect of recovery?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Good question, the million-dollar recovery. If you look at the S&P, people just go, oh, the index is this, or they might own the index in it, and it's going up. But within that index, there's going to be many, many stocks that are going higher, and there's going to be many, many that are going lower. And if you look at the performance of the S&P, The winners of last year are rarely the winners of next year, and quite often the winners tend to be the ones that have done the poorest. So, like, we had a conversation with a client 2 weeks ago about Alamos Gold, and we had pulled out an email from the year before saying we should sell this loser because it was down 60%. We pulled out that email, and that stock is now up 30%. So had we sold that loser, you know, let's remember, there's an old saying, buy low, sell high. Another one of our losers of last year, and again, it's still below, But Coty Corp, which is a chemical company, makes fragrances, is up 71%. It's one of the best performing S&P 500 stocks. It's in the S&P 500. Well, why would we have sold it low? So let's remember, people, within an index, you're going to have two or three stocks. To replace them with last year's winners isn't always necessarily the case. We do evaluate every stock, and if a stock is going to go lower, we would be inclined to sell it. But if it's way artificially low, stocks tend to overshoot on the upside. They tend to overshoot on the downside. Selling losers is not a great strategy.
Okay, Mark, would just like to know your outlook on the price of oil.
That's a good question. We got some news today on oil, and of course we saw the greatest percentage one-day move in oil yesterday on the drone attack in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia came out today and said we'll be at full capacity by the end of September. That being said, so oil should be back at $55 by then. That being said, though, oil stocks are really cheap, and if you look at almost any cycle that I've ever been in, oil goes up at the end of the cycle. I think oil is starting to look like where gold was a year ago. It is hated. Nobody likes it. Nobody wants to own it. Anybody that's owned oil stocks have lost their shirts, especially in Canada. Again, this is a sector, again, that I would not be selling. I would be adding to. So I'm happy to. It's a riskier sector, and I wouldn't go full on, but I think it looks very interesting, and nibbling away just like we nibbled at gold a year ago seems to me not a bad trade to have as part of your portfolio. Again, it's a risk. It may lose, and it's going to be a small part of the portfolio, but risk-reward looks pretty good. Two more, okay.
Can you describe what conditions would need to be present for us to materially raise our cash position? I frequently hear of bonds that return 5%. Do these exist, and would they be a good potential alternative?
That's a good question. Okay, so let's kill the 5% bond notion right now, because everything is priced off the Government of Canada bond curve. And the yield curve says a five-year bond at the Government of Canada is 148 today. And, you know, 2 weeks, August 31st, it was 1.1. So there's been a fairly dramatic rise in rates. So anything that yields five is a junk bond. Okay, now junk bonds default at an average rate of about 5%. So when you're owning five, about 5% of your holdings should be defaulting on a yearly basis. And when you go through a recession, those 5% bonds may be the greatest bubble of the entire sector, because you're not being paid for your risk. So, look, I've said for a while, you can buy Manulife, you can buy Empire Life at a 5.4% dividend, Sun Life at a 5.4% as a straight preferred, and if we think rates are going to stay low, and they're not going to go back to 5 anytime soon, to me, that is an unbelievable risk reward. I will say on this call that I have a conference call that I'm happy to send to clients. I got to be careful. I cannot blast email this out, because the conference call was to fellow advisors. So I make some specific recommendations in the call. And so if I send it to you, I'm happy to send it to you, but you can't forward it to people that aren't clients. It's just a regulatory thing. We can't have recommendations to non-clients. So there is that preferred conference call. It runs about 35 minutes, but I've had some good feedback, but it gets very detailed as to what's happening and the dynamics of that.
Okay, last question. Gary just emailed in. I understand that stocks are attractive longer term, considering the earnings yield on stocks versus bond yields, but does it concern you that commercial hedgers, generally considered the smart money, are still quite bullish of long-term bonds and an increase in volatility?
Well, the volatility we just talked about, for sure volatility is up. Again, people are buying bonds not because they like bonds, but they buy bonds because they have a hedge. If there's anything that keeps me up at night, it's what happens when all of these investing public that have or trillions of dollars into bond exchange-traded funds. What happens when they all flee and they decide that that's a bad investment? We're going to lose control at some point. And Rod had asked about the debt situation. So we've got more and more supply as we run deficits again. Everyone's buying the supply, eating it all up. But at some point, we're going to let go of the bond market, and that's going to be really ugly. Now, again, that's a long ways away. Commercial hedgers, I think that that's all just hedging. I don't think any of these commercial hedgers are buying that for their own accounts. That's my guess. So we have no interest in owning something that doesn't make any sense, and we're not going to own something just for owning it. So, one of the things that people do ask about is gold, and again, I would stay with that trade. You've got the safest currency in the world yielding zero, and you've got German bunds yielding minus 0.8 for 1 year or 2 years, and 10 years at minus 0.3 or 4 for 10-year German bunds. $16 trillion of debt actually you have to pay to own. Well, you don't have to pay to own gold. So in this environment of negative inflation-adjusted, what we call real rates, there needs to be some allocation to gold. That looks a hell of a lot better than the bond market to me. Good. That's it. All right. Thanks, everyone. If we didn't get to your question, we will email us, and we'll happy to respond to an email. So thanks very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the Poitevin Group conference call for today. We thank you for your participation, and have a nice day.